This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Say college basketball and your thoughts automatically turn to North Carolina. Say wine and chances are California or Italy or France come to mind, but this state is trying hard to change that. Prior to Prohibition, North Carolina was a major wine-producing state, but for much of the 20th century, we just could not recover from the impact of that period in our history. However, wine is slowly but surely making a comeback. In the last decade, the number of wineries has tripled from around 48 to 159, and sales exceed those from the state's better-known craft beer industry. We have a long way to go to catch California, which makes 90% of the nation's domestically produced wine, but we're working on it, and this hour, we're talking about it. On this first day of North Carolina Wine and Grape Month, we welcome Whit Winslow, Executive Director of the North Carolina Wine and Grape Council in the State Department of Agriculture. He joins us by phone from Raleigh. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Elizabeth Ann Dover is with us in our Spirit Square studio. She's founder and winemaker at Dover Vineyards in Concord, and assistant winemaker at Rayland Vineyards in Mocksville. I had no idea we had wine, grapes, and wineries sprouting up in Concord.
Yeah, just right beside the Speedway.
Really?
Yeah.
Is that a good place for it? Is there something about the vibrations that makes it?
It's the diesel.
It's the diesel. Yeah. Well, thank you for joining us this morning. Nice to have you here. As I said, at one point, North Carolina's wine industry was, I think, the nation's largest. What kind of wines were we producing back then, Whit?
So the North Carolina wine industry was actually founded on our native muscadine grape. It was based on the mother vine, which was discovered back in the mid-1500s down in the Manio area and on the Cape Fear River. And as that plant was propagated and other muscadine varieties were discovered, it became a very popular choice for wines in the United States, and it was distributed all up and down the colonies at that time.
And in fact, I read that when Sir Walter Raleigh arrived somewhere in the 1500s or 1600s, I'm a little foggy on that, they said that grapes grew so bountifully as to overflow into the ocean. Was that an exaggeration, do you think?
Well, you know, I wasn't there.
Okay.
But I'm told that that is a pretty accurate depiction of it.
Prohibition is said to have crushed the industry here, but the same had to have happened with breweries around the country and distilleries and other wine parts of the country where Prohibition kind of just shut everything down. That lasted from 1919 to 1933. How did they recover and we did not?
So I wouldn't say that we didn't recover. We just took our time getting back into it. And
why?
We experimented with new varieties once Prohibition ended. So the major players in the wine industry in the state prior to Prohibition did not actually reopen after Prohibition. They moved on to other ventures. The families started doing other things. Mm. And after Prohibition, we started working with some of the European varietals and hybrid varietals, such as those that Elizabeth is using now.
And why did we do that? And why did people leave the business? Because they could still make grape juice. They could make grape jelly. They could sell the grapes themselves, it would seem to me. Why did they all get out? Why did the principal producers get out of the business? Do you know?
Well, the wine industry itself was so large at that time mm-hmm. that when the wine portion was gone, they had all this excess of grapes without the infrastructure to sell the juice and the fresh varieties that were other options on the table.
Okay. Prohibition ended in 1933, but in 1947, counties across North Carolina went dry. What did that do to the wine industry? Had there been a mini recovery up to that point, and did that do something to that mini recovery?
So I think that is one aspect of why it may have taken a little bit longer for North Carolina to get back in the game, is that there was some animosity after Prohibition toward the alcohol and spirits industries. Being in the region that we are, that was probably an issue that did take effect.
I can tell you this, and we just talked before we went on the air with Elizabeth about this, that when I used to do a TV show in which cooking was a daily part of the show, whenever Barbara McKay would cook with wine, we would get letters. about how awful it was to use alcohol in your cooking, and yet the alcohol burns off in the cooking process. But that was in the 90s, so there's still some lingering distaste for alcohol in some parts of the state. Certain parts of the world are known for wine. Italy, France, Spain, Argentina is becoming known for its wines. California is king in this country, but there are other parts of the country that are known for wine. Oregon, Washington State, New York, of Virginia, and now North Carolina lends itself to the production of wine grapes and therefore wine. How do we stack up against those other regions, not California, but Oregon, New York, Washington State? How do we stack up in terms of the amount of production, the acceptance of our wines, the quality of what we produce?
Well, the quality is definitely one of the things that North Carolina has going. We are producing some excellent quality wines, and a lot of our vineyards are a little bit younger than those in other regions around the country. And so we're doing a phenomenal job with the vineyards that we are, you know, producing from. And as far as production, obviously, as you pointed out, California is about 90% of the national industry. But North Carolina is still there in the top 10.
Really?
It is.
I was told by a wine broker that a good way to look at this is California versus the East Coast.
It's really California versus the rest of the United States.
Yeah. but New York and Virginia are ahead of the pack in terms of being more recognized and favored by wine drinkers. Would you agree with that? I mean, and if so, how did that happen, given our history of being number one in the country in wine production before Prohibition?
I think that is one of the general sentiments in the greater wine industry, is that, you know, Virginia is known for their vineyards and their kind of tourism aspect, which actually North Carolina is also known for. We have the fifth highest wine tourism industry in the country.
I was actually surprised to hear that Virginia was even in the game. I don't know of a single Virginia wine. I know about New York wine a little bit, but I knew nothing about Virginia, and I was kind of surprised by that, actually. Going back to Walter Raleigh, Sir Walter Raleigh, when the wine making, not industry, but people started making wines out of natively grown scuppernongs and muscadines, those were wines that were very popular prior to the 20th century, and now not so much. And as you said, after Prohibition, winemakers and vineyards began to grow European varietals that perhaps were not as well known in this country as some of the wines that had been produced prior to Prohibition. And that's still the case in North Carolina, isn't it? I mean, are different varietals other than what we've come to know as California wines or French wines? You're nodding your head in recognition of that, Elizabeth. So is that what's going on here still?
There are a lot of great varietals out there that I feel like North Carolina doesn't effectively use, simply because they're not as well known and simply because we can't sell them if we were to make the wine. The muscadines, they're very easy to grow. They're pretty well known and people buy them who like the muscadine wines. But if we could somehow convince people to buy the other lesser known varieties, the things like that I grow, the Chambrisson, the Villard Blanc, even things like Tenat, which is very popular in Uruguay, and Petit Verdot, Cabernet Franc, those things that, you know, might be in California wines, but they don't have the headlines. I think that's where the real future lies, is finding the right varietals for North Carolina.
When you say they don't have the headlines, what does that mean?
They're blending grapes. So they might be in those, you know, a lot of times on your wine labels, they have a name. It might not be Cab Sav. It might be something like the Pure Life. And what does Pure Life mean? What kind of grapes are in that? Well, we don't know. It might be 2% Tenat. and for some reason in North Carolina, Tanat might do really, really well.
And if you buy a bottle that just says red table wine,
right,
that's a blend of a bunch of stuff.
Yes, we don't know what that is. Yeah.
It was into this reality that you decided to get into the wine business, the fact that North Carolina is struggling to become on par with some other states, particularly California, although I'm thinking that's probably a long road ahead. But you opened Dover Vineyards in, I think, 2009, if that's correct.
Correct.
And on your website, you say, unlike many vineyards and wineries, we truly have no good story as to why we started out on this venture. So in the absence of a good story, what is the story?
Well, I would say I was in college at Davidson, and I didn't really have anything to do afterwards. And I was talking to my professors, trying to figure out what would be the next step for me, and they recommended consulting. And that just seemed like a terrible idea for me. I knew I needed to be outside, and my family has done manual labor since I don't know when. And so for me to sit in an office would have been something unknown. And I was just questioning what to do with my life. And the fact of the matter is we had some unused family land, probably heard something on PBS about the growing wine industry and that it was going to be a challenge. And, well, I like challenges. And so I decided, why not give it a try?
So was your family in agriculture, in farming?
Well, my grandparents on both sides were farmers.
Okay.
My parents owned a grocery store. And my mom was a teacher. So my parents were not directly involved in agriculture, but my extended family to this day is big into farming.
What did you know about growing grapes specifically, and what did you know about making wine specifically that made you believe that this would be successful for you at that point in your life?
Very little. I knew very, very little. I just knew that my family had grown tobacco on a farm down east, which we still have, and I saw a program, like I said, on PBS that mentioned turning tobacco land into grape-growing land. And as it turns out, the tobacco land that we have down east is not suited for the type of wine that we want to grow. But the land that we do have around here was suited for growing the vinifera and the French American hybrids that we grow.
You know, if you want to plant tobacco, and all things work in your favor, or if you want to plant wheat or soybeans or corn, and the rain comes and the sun shines and things work out, you're going to have a crop that you can take to market that year. That is not the case with wine. It takes a long time, doesn't it, to establish vines? How did you start?
Well, we started out in 2009. We planted, and then we expected.
What did you plant? You don't plant seeds. Do you actually get cuttings from other vines?
Yes, there is a they're nurseries, and they're sticks, basically.
Okay.
And when we were planting the vineyard, we had a little boy drive by, or his mother drove by, and he just pointed out the window, and he said, "Look, Mom, a pole farm," because we had a bunch of little sticks in the ground. And we had our poles for the trellis system and little bamboos that train up the vines. So we put these little sticks in the ground, and then we basically don't do anything to them the first year. We let them grow, establish their roots, and then we start training them up the second and third year. And by that third year, you hopefully have a crop that you can harvest.
Wow, that's patience. That's amazing. We'll talk more about how this works and how the process of making wine and the health of the wine industry in North Carolina as we go through the hour with Elizabeth Ann Dover, founder and winemaker at Dover Vineyards, and Whit Winslow, executive director of the North Carolina Wine and Grape Council. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and UNC-TV, presenting Big Blue Live, PBS's special three-day coverage of the renewal of thriving aquatic life in Monterey Bay, California, tonight at 9. Well, this summer here on Charlotte Talks, we have been visiting the Ring Cities, the towns that circle Charlotte and make it the region that it is. We've been to Matthews and Belmont and Waxhaw, and now it's up to I-77 Anta Davidson, perhaps best known, obviously, for Davidson College and the town's historic downtown. Like other ring cities, they've been growing like crazy, and they have the challenge of managing that growth and maintaining what makes Davidson special. We'll find out how they're doing it tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, President Obama travels to Alaska to call for global action on climate change. But critics say Arctic drilling authorized by the Obama administration undercuts that goal. Addressing global climate change, the future of Arctic drilling, and a president's legacy.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the first day of North Carolina Wine and Grape Month, and so we're talking about North Carolina wines with Whit Winslow, Executive Director of the Wine and Grape Council here in North Carolina, and Elizabeth Ann Dover, founder and winemaker at Dover Vineyards, believe it or not, in Concord, planted their first crop of grapes in 2009. Took you about 3 days to put how many vines in?
2,234.
Hokey smokes. And it took 3 years then for those to develop to the point where you could actually harvest grapes.
Correct.
When they're that young, does it matter how young the vines are in terms of harvesting the grapes for wine production?
Well, the younger, I like to equate vines to humans.
Okay.
So whenever you have young vines having grapes, it's like having teenage pregnancies. So the grapes may not ripen all at the same time. You might get some grapes with higher sugars, some grapes with lower sugars. And it's just more difficult to predict when that harvest is going to be because the vine isn't prepared to have children yet. It's not quite ready to raise all the children that it has at the same time. So as the vine matures, it can take care of its babies better. It knows more about what it's going through, how to ripen them all at the same time, and you get a better harvest simply because the vines are older. They have a more established roots system, and probably the canopy, the green leaves, is more established.
So how long does that take for a vine to become mature, so to speak?
Science says 5 years.
Okay.
My experience is that our vines lag behind that.
So does that give you a higher quality or a more predictable juice for the wine? And what's the impact of it before it becomes mature? Is it the kind of wine that you drink quickly and talk to me about that.
Well, the first year that we harvested it early because the leaves were starting to turn yellow. We could tell that the vines were tired of raising their children for that year, and they wanted to be harvested. So we harvested them a little bit early, and that made a younger wine. It was a little bit more acidic than people are probably used to here. We equate it to a New Zealand-style Pinot Noir, or something I'm sure you're familiar with, Beaujolais Nouveau. We didn't turn it out in the short period that Beaujolais Nouveau requires, but we did make a light, fruity red wine that it's not meant to be aged. We didn't put it in oak for a long period of time. We didn't, you know, put it in barrels that had a lot of char in it. If we had done that, the char would have overpowered the fruity notes, and it would have just tasted blah.
Now, you know, just talking to you, you know a lot about this, and you were a Davidson student who had no intention of going into the wine business, and suddenly you plant some vines, and now you're in the wine business, and all of a sudden you know all this stuff. How did you learn this? How did you learn it all?
I didn't just all of a sudden. It took a few years. And I mean, I'm only 30, so I've only legally been able to drink wine for 9 years.
Right.
So you have to be have a concerted effort whenever you're drinking wine. Also, I went to NC State to study viticulture, and I took some classes at Appalachian. Also went abroad to New Zealand and studied wine down there, and I had the opportunity to work in Australia. During the off seasons here, I could go to the other hemisphere whenever it was winter here and work down there.
Do you have to have, as a winemaker, do you have to have the palate of a sommelier?
I would say yes, in that it's really, really important. A lot of people think that tasting wine is a party trick and that being able to identify the flavors is, you know, just for show. But it really serves a purpose in telling what you need to do with the wine, how you can improve the wine that you're making, how you can identify faults and what's going on. But you don't want to have to take samples from the tank and send them to a lab and then wait right. to see the results. You want to be able to taste the problems you're going to have to fix that day.
I've been to wine tastings, and some people really can't taste what the head taster is telling you he or she tastes. They just can't taste it. And for them, it's kind of wasted on them. But for others, they may have had the experience of drinking wine, and it just tastes like wine. But when you point out there's a little essence of that or overtones of this or the front of your mouth is tasting this while the back of your mouth, you go, aha, I do taste that. And that brings out the pleasure of it, I guess. Whit, you and others will be at the North Carolina State Fair today, in fact, judging North Carolina wines. If the past is any indication, what types of wines, which wineries are likely to come out ahead in this?
Well, excuse me. We do have the state fair wine competition this week, and we have 10 judges coming in for that. They're all established, well-trained judges, certified for this task, and they will pick, you know, whichever one tastes the best to them. Over the past few years, the trophy has gone to many different wineries. I wouldn't say there's a single one that has, you know, a clear shot at it. Everybody's got a chance this year.
What kinds of wines seem to be the winners?
Well, we award two trophies. One is sponsored by the North Carolina Wine Growers Association, which is predominantly the vinifera and hybrid style grapes. So that's going to be the Chamberson that Elizabeth grows, as well as your Chardonnays and Cab Francs that she mentioned a minute ago. And then we also have a trophy sponsored by the North Carolina Muscadine Grape Association, and that goes to a winery that produces one of the Muscadine style wines.
And if past is any indication, how will the winning wines stack up against wines from other parts of the country, other parts of the world?
Well, wine is very subjective, and everybody kind of enjoys it to their own degree. But I've always enjoyed the ones that have come out of our trophies. I've always thought they were very good.
You're being cagey with me, aren't you?
Not at all.
Okay. Now, I mentioned, Elizabeth, that not only are you the founder and winemaker of your own vineyard, but you are still the assistant winemaker at Ray Lynn.
Hopefully, after hearing this interview, they're not going to...
Yeah, at Ray Lynn Vineyards, and they are in Mocksville. Did they help you gain the experience that you obviously have, or the understanding, the knowledge that you obviously have in helping you start your own?
Definitely.
And when you went to work for them, had you already started your own? Operation.
Yes. So the way that our relationship works is I grow the grapes that for our own wine, and then I take them to Ray Lynn, and they make the wine for us. However, I am employed by Ray Lynn, so I'm making my own wine, and then I purchase it back from Ray Lynn. So it's a contract. It's a wonderful arrangement, and I get to work under the expertise of a winemaker who's been doing this for a very long time and has lots of expertise, and I'm very, very grateful to have the opportunity to learn while starting my own.
I've talked to other winemakers from other parts of the country. This seems to be the way it works. There's a lot of help back and forth,
right.
People cooperating with each other. Is that unusual in the world of agriculture, or is that just something particular to the world of wine?
No. I've found that in agriculture, if you get your tractor stuck, someone is going to have a tractor going by that can pull your tractor out. So the sense that there's a lot of competition in the wine industry is that that's very unfounded in North Carolina. I have been able to call up a lot of other winemakers and visit a lot of wineries, get tours, get tips, get a lot of advice. Everybody is really helpful, very friendly. I have a produce farm as well, and I have a cousin who is a produce farmer, and if I have a problem, I can call him up, and he answers my questions. So I feel very supported by other farmers.
I understand that one of the things that has given North Carolina's wine industry a boost was the Golden Leaf Foundation offering financial incentives to farmers to switch from growing tobacco to growing grapes. That started, I think, in 1999. Given what has happened, and certainly what had happened by then to the tobacco industry, why did they need an incentive to switch?
Well, as Elizabeth said earlier, in a lot of cases, wine-growing regions and tobacco-growing regions are very similar. And so as farmers were getting away from tobacco, the Golden Leaf Foundation's always had a great record of trying to help farmers find new crops in a lot of cases, as well as helping them with their tobacco crops. And so they were great in helping a lot of the farmers make that transition and find new avenues, and wine was one of the more popular ones.
It takes about $10,000 per acre to plant an acre of grapes. And so any sort of financial assistance that we can receive from the state is vital to making that switch.
But unlike tobacco or soybeans, you're planting once.
And you're waiting 4 years before you get a return on that planting. So you really do need some sort of support if we're going to be making the switch. Mm-hmm. From the tobacco had a buyer that was ready. The distribution channels, the auctions, it was all very well established. Now, for these people who just in the early or in the late 90s who were making that transition from planting tobacco to grapes, there was no market for their grapes. They could plant the grapes, but what would they do with the grapes afterwards?
Mm-hmm.
Were there any wineries around that could process? Probably not. Not only are you doing the grapes, you have to have the winery as well. And then once you have the winery, who's going to buy it? So you have to establish all these channels. You're not just planting the grapes, but you're creating a whole business.
Now, Whit just mentioned that you're growing, or you're I guess you're growing Chambersin. Is that
Chambersin?
Is that the grape, or is that
yes.
The wine? Okay, you're one of the state's newest wineries. You've just mm-hmm. begun marketing your wines. I think 2012 and 2013 were the first 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
How would you describe the wines that you're producing at the moment?
I have the 2012, like I said, is a very new style wine. It's very young. It's got some good acidity to it. It's got hints of black cherry and a little bit of smoke in there. The 2013, we waited a bit. We harvested it later, so it had higher sugars, which means it had a little bit higher alcohol and a little less acidity. It's got it's smoother than the 2012, and it's got more robust flavor.
Now, is that because of the maturity of the vine, or is that because it's not a distillery, it's not a brewery. I'm not sure what you call it. Yeah, your winery. Is it the process of the wine making itself causing that to happen?
It was the grapes were 1 year older. That's a little bit important, but the thing that really determined it was the fact that we waited about 3 weeks later in the growing season to harvest the grapes. So they were allowed to hang on the vine longer. They dehydrated a little bit. And the acidity, as the grapes stay on the vine longer every year, the acidity goes down a little bit.
The sweetness goes up?
The sweetness goes up, the acidity goes down.
Okay. Mm-hmm. In the Loire Valley of France, these grapes that you're growing, the Chambersins, are used to produce rosés and red table wine. Is that how you're using these grapes?
I did make a rosé with the Chambersin last year, and it was amazing. I have really enjoyed drinking that this summer. It's got a little bit of fizz to it, which is very refreshing.
That's nice,
yeah,
yes.
It is very nice. I have, like I said, I have to not open that at home because, you know, I got like 200 cases of it. So that's my dangerous wine for the summer.
Now, this grape that you grow is generally, I read yesterday, is generally grown in cooler areas in this country, like the Northeast, the Midwest, Canada. This would seem to be a much warmer, much more humid area and to grow grapes that seem to do well in those parts of the country. Do they do well well here, and why would you grow those grapes given the fact that the climate is so different here?
The fact of the matter is we are probably one of the southernmost vineyards in the state. I would venture to say in the United States that grows this sort of, mm-hmm. Or at least we're not the southernmost, but we're one of the warmest, and that's what the temperature is what really matters. So anything that we grow is basically going to be taking something from somewhere else that is cooler and growing it here. So it's doing well. We lost half of our vineyard the first year to something called Pierce's disease.
Mm-hmm.
We were growing Vidal Blanc, and that is a grape that is popular in Canada for making ice wine. So we were definitely the southernmost planting of that, and we lost it within 2 years. So it is just trial and error here. And again, it takes, 4 years for you to get any money coming back off of this. So for us to lose half of our vineyard the second year, so that means we're waiting 6 years now to get money off of that grape growing space.
This does not sound like a venture that most people should get involved in, unless you have a real sense of risk. If you're risk averse, you don't want to do this.
Exactly.
What kind of wines and what kind of grapes are we growing around the state? What kind of grapes are we growing? What kind of wines are we producing around the state with?
Well, we actually have one of the most diverse growing regions in the world. There are 9 major classes of grape. Vinifera being one, Muscadine being one, then there's Labrusca, Lipari, and a few others. And actually, North Carolina has the ability to grow different varietals from each of those classes. So we have one of the most diverse growing regions in the world. And then, we have these great wineries producing the vinifera style, the hybrids that we were just talking about, the Muscadines. We actually have the largest Muscadine winery in the world. In Rose Hill, Duplin Winery,
mm-hmm.
Which is kind of something that a lot of people don't realize, that is such a huge industry. And then, as Elizabeth was talking about earlier, different varietals that work well in the state, her Chamberson is one of the red varieties that does extremely well here, as well as the Cabernet Franc that she mentioned. Little lesser known to its offspring, the Cabernet Sauvignon, which is a hybrid of Cabernet Franc and Sauvignon Blanc, but it's the parent to that, and it does really well here in North Carolina.
And we're also producing, I'm told, Merlots and Syrahs and the Chardonnays and Avoignier, and I think Raffaldini in Wilkes County, that winery produces what they call Chianti. I'm not sure it is Chianti, but that's what they call it. What has been the impact of this long, hot summer and the drought that we're in, at least in this part of the state, on grape growing and wine production?
I have had a rough year. I will say that Raylan Vineyards, where I work, has well-established vines, and they have been able to weather it beautifully, and their grapes are turning out wonderfully, and their yields are great. The quality is excellent. The sugars are where they should be. I, on the other hand, that have a newly established vineyard, the root systems weren't there. We had some vascular damage due to the harsh winters that we've had. Mm-hmm. And we had a lot of berries drop off the vine.
Right.
Yeah, so it's been rough.
You want to add to that, Whit?
I've actually been hearing great reports from all across the state, from the Outer Banks up to the mountains. Everybody's been saying pretty much consistently that they've been seeing just a great harvest this year. The drought that may not be good for a lot of normal row crops is actually kind of nice for grapes because, as Elizabeth mentioned earlier, it allows them a chance to dehydrate a bit, and so they're not so full of water and more full of the juice that is better for the winemaking. Both folks are pretty excited.
All people in agriculture have they're at the mercy of the vagaries of the weather. Too hot, too cold, too wet, too dry, etc. At what point do you, as a grape grower and a wine maker, know that the grapes are going to be good for wine and the wine is going to be good? And you have 10 seconds to answer that question.
2 days before you pick.
2 days before you pick. And,
yeah.
And in the process of making the wine, when do you know that the wine itself will be good?
Right when you start making it.
We'll talk about why that is when we come back. We're talking about North Carolina wines on Charlotte Talks here on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and UNC Charlotte Executive Education, offering programs in analytics, innovation, and leadership this fall. More at exec-ed.uncc.edu/WFAE. Well, President Obama travels to Alaska to call for global action on climate change, but critics say Arctic drilling authorized by the Obama administration undercuts that goal. So, addressing global climate change, the future of Arctic drilling, and a president's legacy, the topic of the conversation in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. If perhaps you'd like to join our conversation about wine in North Carolina, you can do so. Email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter, and we're coming right back.
Hi, I'm Scott Simon. So many things I love in life. My wife, my daughters, Chicago, raindrops on roses, whiskers on kittens. I've never loved cars, but then I found out you can donate your old car to this station and turn it into things that you and I both love. Morning edition, weekend edition, fresh air, all things considered. Wouldn't it be great to turn your car into something we all love?
Call 1-866-789-8627.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about North Carolina wines on this first day of North Carolina Wine and Grape Month with Whit Winslow, Executive Director of the North Carolina Wine and Grape Council at the Department of Agriculture in Raleigh. He joins us by phone. And with us in our Spirit Square studio, the founder and winemaker at Dover Vineyards in Concord and the assistant winemaker at Raylan Vineyards in Mocksville, Elizabeth Ann Dover. We were talking about when you know the wine you're about to make is going to be good. Does it depend on what the grape juice tastes like and what you've been able to get off the vines that year, and you know this is going to be a good wine, or does that happen later in the fermentation process that you know?
Well, you can normally tell right off the bat if the grapes are good quality and they have lots of flavor and they're sweet and the seeds are dark brown. You can take those grapes, taste them, chew them up, and see what flavors come across. Mm-hmm. And if they're good, then they're going to make a good wine. It's much trickier, and some people would argue impossible to make a good wine from compromised grapes. It just depends on your philosophy. But you can tell right from the moment that you pick what kind of wine it's going to make.
For those who may think of California as being the wine state in America, and it certainly is because they do produce 90% of the wines that we drink, from domestic wines that we drink, the North Carolina wine industry, Whit, I'm told, is a $1.7 billion industry. Is that right?
Yes, sir. It's a $1.71 billion, and that's according to 2013 data. The way these numbers are collected, it takes about a year later before you can actually get an accurate number. And so that's 2013, and that's actually up 33% since 2009.
And that sounds like an enormous number, $1.7 billion. Can you put that into some sort of perspective for us? How big an industry does that make it?
Well, that makes it 159 wineries as of today and over 400 growers in the state.
That's a lot.
But that $1.71 billion, that includes the vineyards, the wineries, that includes tourism, folks coming to the wineries to sit out on the patio and drink Elizabeth's Rosé Chamberson. That's everything.
I think you or somebody else have plotted out all of the vineyards in the state on the map of North Carolina, and when you look at it, they're everywhere. It's like
the state is
blanketed with wineries. Who knew?
Sir, if you look at ncwine.org, we have a tab there for wineries, and that shows all the wineries across the state, and it even breaks them out into different categories. So you have the mountains, the Piedmont, the coast, and then some of the viticultural areas in the state now.
And I also mentioned earlier in the program that sales of North Carolina wines have eclipsed the state's better-known craft beer industry. Is that a recent development?
Well, it's something that's been ongoing. We've both been, the wine and the beer industries have both been growing for some time now. I think that one of the reasons why our impact is a little bit stronger, so much stronger, rather, is that we do have that tourism component. Folks coming out to the vineyard, seeing where the grapes are grown, where the wine is made, and getting to see that agricultural component there on site and sitting down and having a bottle of wine.
But I'm wondering about that because, you know, the breweries that are around Charlotte, we have a lot of craft breweries around Charlotte. I know the same is true in other parts of the state like Asheville and perhaps up in Wake County as well. It's growing
Absolutely.
Up in there. And these are all in urban areas where the breweries usually have a beer garden or they have some place where you can actually enjoy what they're producing, where they're producing it. And they have taps at various bars and pubs in the area serving their brew of the month, their brew of the season, whatever it may be. And there are a lot more people in urban areas who maybe get off from work and go have a brewski and then go home. But to do the wine thing, you have to be a weekend tourist or on vacation and go do the winery tours and have wine on the patio. Although a lot of people come to that, it's not as frequent, and it would seem to me to be a fewer number of people. Is that wrong? Because the urban nature of craft breweries, they're right there in the heart of everything. You're out in the country.
You know, you're not wrong. There are great craft breweries all across the state, and a lot of them do tend to fall in some of these more urban areas, like you said, Charlotte, the Triad, Raleigh. And I kind of equate it to going to a brewery as an activity, going to a winery as an experience.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little more involved when you're committing to go into a winery. You go, you take half a day. You kind of get a tour, you relax, you see the winery, you talk to the winemaker. whereas with the brewers, it is a lot of the same things, but you don't get that same experience of seeing, you know, where the grains are grown, where the hops are coming from, because that's just something that we're not doing just yet.
Go ahead.
I would say that... You've brought up a really important thing about distribution.
Yeah.
And it is a struggle for North Carolina wines to get into the proper distribution channels. And I think that a lot of our target markets are going to be in the urban areas, and they're going to be amongst similar people to those who enjoy the craft brew, the craft breweries.
Why?
People who like interesting drinks, who will pay a little bit more to have something that's distinctive.
Mm-hmm.
Our target market should be lining up fairly equally.
I also read that maybe one of the wine challenges, the wine industry in North Carolina's challenges may be that we're more of a boutique industry than these massive winemaking enterprises in California that have national distribution. So they can put a bottle of wine on a grocery store shelf for $10 to $12, and it takes $15 to put a bottle of North Carolina wine on the shelf. Now, how difficult does that make it for you to be successful when you got a $12 bottle of wine with a cute animal on the label, and a $15 bottle of wine from North Carolina?
It makes it a huge challenge, and we count on our neighbors every day to say we're going to support local. That is probably the reason that we're able to grow as quickly as we do is because our neighbors are supporting us.
Well, the local food movement has certainly helped the craft beer mm-hmm. industry. Is that what's helping you guys? Because it's local. It was made here. It wasn't transported across the country.
I don't think that the North Carolina wine industry has not been able to tap into the local food movement as strongly as the brewing industry has. What I think really contributes to us is, like Whit said, is the experience. People want an experience. They want to get away for a day, and they want to spend some money on themselves, on their girlfriends, on relaxing, and that is the real driver here.
So is your business growing grapes? Is your business making wine? Or is your business hosting tourists who come to drink the wine on your patio?
It depends on the winery. It really does. We don't have a place for you to come and visit.
Okay.
For Dover Vineyards, it is specifically the wine.
Okay.
And that's what we're focused on. We don't have a building. We don't have a tasting room in the traditional sense.
Is that something you aspire to? Is that something that really is necessary to build a relationship, particularly with a new winery? With your customers?
It is essential in the future, I think, for us to grow. As of right now, with 4 acres of grapes, we can't afford a
right.
building.
Right.
The amount of wine that the 4 acres produce does not allow us to have a building.
I've read that 20% of all of the North Carolina wines produced in the state are consumed at the wineries. They're bought,
mm-hmm.
at least they're bought at the wineries, which leads me to a question. If you don't have a place like that, then 100% of your wine has to be sold somehow through distribution channels. How difficult is it to get North Carolina wines shelf space in the stores?
I would say that because of the varieties that we have and the price points that we have, the experience that I've had is it's near impossible. And the ways that I've been able to get it into Charlotte area stores is by having personal relationships with sommeliers, with chefs, with the proprietors and people who really believe in North Carolina wines. And it's those personal relationships. It's not going through the distribution channels that traditional wineries go through.
What's the story around the state, Whit?
It seems to be a lot of that. A lot of people are finding success by going directly to the retailers that they are selling to and letting those retailers have a chance to taste the wines, give them a bottle to try, and, you know, let them see for themselves that this their wines have, you know, market potential, that they are going to sell. You know, they're excellent quality. Going back to what you said a minute ago about boutique wineries and what Elizabeth said about the local movement, the beer industry does have a great opportunity with the beers going statewide and calling it local, whereas wineries are doing it more hyper-local. So they're staying around their specific regions. So a lot of the smaller wineries in the western part of the state may not be selling in the eastern part of the state, but they're selling to a lot of their retailers right there in that area to a very enthusiastic consumer demographic.
So we asked our listeners if they drink North Carolina wines, and they've been responding to us on various social media. Bill from Matthews says, how many wineries, vineyards are there currently in North Carolina? I think the answer is 159. And where are they located? All over the state is the answer. Could you ask your guests what they might know about Sidney Weller and Paul Garrett, early pioneers in winemaking in North Carolina? He says it's an interesting story. Do you know that story, Whit?
I do. So Paul Garrett is the owner of the winery that I mentioned earlier, prior to Prohibition, that sold wine up and down the East Coast throughout the colonies at the time. And the popular wine that he made was called the Virginia Dare wine.
And was that a Muscadine or a Scuppernong wine? What was that?
It was. He made a red and a white. So the Scuppernong is actually a white variety, a golden variety of the Muscadine grape. And so he made Scuppernong and other varieties of the Muscadine grape.
And as we've said, those were incredibly popular wines back then, but not so much anymore. People don't know them. We know Cabernet, we know Chardonnay, we know, Sauvignon Blanc, things like that. We don't know these wines. So
I would not go that far, actually. As I mentioned earlier, Duplin Winery is the largest Muscadine winery in the world, and they're right here in North Carolina, and they sell a great deal of wine. They produce nearly 500,000 cases of wine a year, and one of their labels is actually the best-selling wine in North and South Carolina.
Well, Aaron on Facebook says, I love wine, in all capital letters. One of my favorites are the Muscadine wines. I would love to have more options available in North Carolina. Any comment on that?
Absolutely. There are Muscadine wines available statewide at most major retailers and grocers. She can find, assuming she is in the state, she can find them pretty close to wherever she is.
William on Facebook writes, my parents and I visited Woodmill Winery in Vail a few years ago. It's a beautiful place. Harry on Facebook, I like Treehouse Vineyards. Very sweet, very good Muscadine wines. Jeremy on Facebook, Flint Hill Vineyards are awesome.
Thank you.
Is that yours?
No, Raylan makes their wine, and so I get to...
Take credit.
Yeah. No, I don't get to take credit. But yeah.
Teresa on Facebook, Dennis Vineyard, the Carlos Sweet is my favorite. I'm not sure what that is. Maybe you can enlighten us, Whit.
Carlos is one of the golden Muscadine varieties, actually. It's one of the most popular Muscadine grapes used for wine.
Pike on Facebook, Over Mountain Vineyard makes some great wines, especially their blackberry wine. How popular is blackberry wine these days?
Blackberry's taken a real turn the past couple of years. It's become very popular, and a lot of folks are actually fortifying it as well and making dessert wines out of it. And it's become a very popular product because blackberries do so well here in North Carolina.
Jenny, in Western North Carolina, how do we go about finding good North Carolina wines for a restaurant in Western North Carolina that will open in 4 to 6 weeks? Some wineries seem to think a 10% discount is wholesale, but not. How do you discover which wineries have the quality and quantity to deal successfully in wholesale?
I would go visit the wineries themselves and just look at the size. And if you can, if they have a few people working there for them full time, then they can go wholesale. If they are struggling to employ two people full time making the wine and growing the grapes all themselves, then they need to be making as much money as they can. They need to be doing 100% retail.
Christina from Shelton Vineyards writes, I wanted to comment on the comparison being drawn between the quality of North Carolina wines versus wines from other regions like California. It's important to understand that each wine-producing region has varying soils and climates that affect the ultimate flavor of a wine, a concept known as terroir. It's a little French word. So, when consumers try North Carolina wines, they need to prepare their minds for the fact that they will not taste the same, but will display the same level of quality, if not better, than other regions. If you're going to try a traditional varietal from North Carolina, try the Cabernet Franc from Shelton Vineyards. It's a 100% estate-grown in Dobson, North Carolina, and displays a tremendous amount of character with lots of subtle fruit and spice on the finish. It's an excellent display of Yadkin Valley terroir. You know, there are different flavors of Chardonnay and different flavors of Cabernet, and it does depend on where they're grown. So what kind of character do these varietals have in the wines produced in North Carolina?
I think we're still discovering that. We're a very new wine-growing region, and it takes time for us to discover what the characteristics are which we're producing. And I think a lot of people need to understand that a flavor that is new to you does not mean that the wine is bad. There are chemical reasons that a wine goes bad or is not up to par, but that doesn't mean that new flavors or a combination of flavors that you might not have experienced in a California wine, that doesn't mean that wine is bad.
So if a California Cabernet tastes one way and an equally good North Carolina Cabernet tastes another, how do you decide whether it's a good wine to your palate?
It's what you want.
It's what you want. Where do you see the wine industry? Where do you see the wine industry in the state going, Whit, in the next couple of years in 10 seconds or less?
Well, I see the industry continuing to grow with the rate that it has. We're growing by about 10 wineries per year, and I don't see that slowing down.
Whit Winslow is Executive Director of the North Carolina Wine and Grape Council. This is the first day of North Carolina Wine and Grape Month. He's on his way to the State Fair to judge North Carolina wines. Elizabeth Ann Dover, founder and winemaker at Dover Vineyards in Concord. Thank you both for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. Our producers are Aaron Kiever and Tim Ross. Our engineer is Joey Sprinkle. For more information about archives, upcoming shows, and podcasts, or to continue the conversation online, visit our website.